After a year of losses and scandals, what does the future hold for cryptocurrency? Our guest has an opinion about that.
I would welcome regulation. And let me share some analysis that I have in terms of what regulation exists and where we need to go.
Today's guest is founder and general partner at Morgan Creek Capital, Sachin Jaitly. He's here to tell us about the future of blockchain technology, cryptocurrency, and much more on this episode of Crummer Connections. Welcome to Crummer Connections podcast series. I'm your host, JB Adams. In this series, I'm talking with members of the Crummer community and inviting them to share their accomplishments, challenges, and best business advice. Today's show is brought to you by the Crummer Graduate School of Business at Rollins College. Consistently ranked as the number one MBA in the state of Florida, the Crummer School offers a variety of educational programs to prepare you to become a global, responsible, and innovative business leader. The Crummer Graduate School of Business, experience excellence. This season of Crummer Connections is devoted to influencers in our community, and today's guest is founder and general partner at Morgan Creek Capital, Sachin Jaitly. He's had years of experience in venture capital, both as an investor and as an entrepreneur. In his late 20s, he was the co-founder and CEO of FlexEngage, a digital receipt solution, which won the Crummer Venture Plan competition in 2012 and was acquired by Klarna, which is one of the largest fintech companies in Europe. After that, he joined Datalogix, where he led business development efforts until the company was acquired by Oracle. Since that time, he has founded two venture capital partnerships, Tessera Venture Partners, which invests in early-stage blockchain and artificial intelligence companies, and Morgan Creek Digital, which invests in early-stage Web3 companies that leverage blockchain, AI, digital assets, and cryptocurrency. As a student of everything related to blockchain and Web3, he's about to complete his doctoral studies at the University of Florida, where his focus is on the dynamics between cryptocurrency and monetary policy. Sachin Jaitly, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, JB. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. We're going to jump right into the current state of the cryptocurrency market. This past year, we saw a lot of surprising and quite frankly, disturbing activity in the market. After the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates, a lot of investors sold off their digital assets. Crypto saw a major decrease in value. Bitcoin is worth less than half of what it was from a year ago. And of course, FTX, which at one time was the third largest crypto exchange, filed for bankruptcy amid charges of fraud. Quite a scandal. So as we head into 2023, what is your reflection on this past year? And what do you anticipate in the coming year for crypto?
So this is a real interesting question. It's a very meaty one. And the reason is because our industry, outside of kind of the insiders of our industry, it's a little known fact that our industry operates on four-year cycles. This is a very important macro condition that we should touch on before we dive into all these specific events that you mentioned. So every 4 years, there's what's known as the halving cycle. Okay. And in this instance of the halving cycle, the prices of crypto, the crypto markets peak. And the following year, there's a trough. Mm-hmm. And each peak is greater than the last peak. Each trough is greater than the last trough. So there's almost this upward and to the right trajectory of each peak and each trough every 4 years. So if you think back, this is more tongue in cheek than anything, but there's probably some truth to this. If you think back across the last 12 years or so, you probably recall in 2013, sitting at Thanksgiving dinner with family and friends in 2013, and people were asking, what is this magic internet money? What's going on here? Should we invest in it? Should we not? I don't understand it. This is hogwash, or this is someone probably at the table saying, no, there's something real here. And so that happened in 2013, and that was the peak of the first cycle. In 2014, there was a crash, right? And everybody was like, whoa, I'm glad I didn't get into the crypto markets in 2013. I dodged that bullet. Same thing happened in 2017. So 2017, it peaks. 2018, it crashes, right? Now, that peak was greater than 2013, and that trough was greater than 2014. Once again, in 2021, we had another peak. 2022 was expected to be a trough. It was expected to be a trough that was going to be greater than the previous cycles. But nonetheless, we were expecting this. So I would say our nuclear community that research, study, invest in the space, we're expecting this all to occur in 2022. But I should be fair in saying there have been landmines that have been hit in 2022 that have compounded the situation further. And by the way, I should also, on a macro level, the reason for these cycles that occur, I won't go into too much detail around the technology unless you would like me to, but the reason for this is because of a simple fact. Algorithmically, as a part of the code that is anchored into, particularly in Bitcoin, the supply is constrained every 4 years.
Mm.
And if your demand stays flat and your supply goes down, well, your price should go up. Like, just basic economic theory there, right? And so that is what occurs every 4 years. Supply is constrained, prices spike. And by the way, I will predict in 2025, we're going to have another Thanksgiving meal with everybody around the table saying, should I own this magic internet money? In 2026, there'll be another crash, right?
So, please,
go ahead.
No, go. Well, what I was going to say is, you're making it sound like this is so predictable that we should get in the market now and cash out in 2025.
Well, I do want to just caveat something before we continue any further. Although I am a financial professional and I do study these markets, this is a volatile asset class, and anybody who would like to get involved in crypto markets should do their own diligence, do their own research, and make their own decisions. What is intended for today is purely educational and just to discuss both what I do as a professional and what I do in my experiences since Kremer. But I will let you draw a conclusion of what you just said.
Oh, well, then I'll summarize. Today's conversation between Sachin and JB is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. You shouldn't make any hard decisions based on it.
Great. So I think I will tell you, as a part of our investment thesis, right now is a great time to buy high value assets that will be driven up in value over the next 3.5 years. And so as a part of our thesis, the one that we've done diligence on, we would share sentiment of what you just outlined, that now is a great opportunity to deploy capital, access. And I do want to draw a distinction of something. Everybody really talks about Bitcoin and the crypto markets, and there's good reason to do that. And that takes out about 80, 90% of the oxygen in any conversation.
Right.
But what I spend most of my day on, what I spend most of my attention on in reality, is blockchain as an infrastructure. Blockchain, which is the underlying technology that, to in our opinion, will deliver an enormous amount of value over the next decade. And it will. And the analogy is this. Over the last 10 years, the whole world, every company, every region of the world, every industry migrated on top of cloud architecture. Now, the average person didn't know that this was happening, but every company went on this migration over a decade-long migration. And we see the benefits now, right? Our files sync with our computers that sync with our phones. Everything is tied together for a wonderful user experience. 10 years ago, that was not the case. We downloaded movies, we downloaded files, we downloaded music onto hardware, but now everything lives in clouds. And the beneficiaries of that migration were early investors in cloud architecture.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is happening over the next decade. Our investment thesis is anchored around an idea that the whole world would be migrating on top of blockchain architecture. And so, and what the average person on the street won't know that this migration is happening, but what they will feel is that the world will be moving faster in terms of transactions at less cost. So faster and cheaper is what the average Joe on the street will feel as a result of the blockchain migration. And so that's where I spend the majority of my time, is focus on the blockchain as an infrastructure layer for financial services, for gaming, for social media, for every industry. There's going to be an underpinning of blockchain architecture. And that's really where I spend 80, 90% of my time on.
All right. Well, you have clarified for me and for all of us what the potential is for the future of blockchain and how blockchain supports cryptocurrency. So I want to thank you for that. But right now, we're going to shift to the big story of this past year, and that is specifically the collapse of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. So here's a little background for our listeners. FTX is a cryptocurrency exchange. It was founded in 2019. By July of 2021, at its peak, it had over 1 million users and was valued at over $18 billion. Through a series of acquisitions, the company grew very quickly to become the third largest cryptocurrency exchange. Then, in November of 2022, there was a series of events that brought FTX down. There was a liquidity crisis, a run on the exchange, employees resigned, so on and so forth. And the end of the story is that within a few days, billions of dollars of value evaporated, and Sam Bankman-Fried has been arrested and charged with fraud. So what I want to know from you is, did you ever meet Sam Bankman-Fried? And if so, what were your impressions of him? And from your point of view, what were the signals or red flags that let you and other investors know that this was not a safe investment? What should we be looking for?
Sure. So there's specifically to answer your questions, I have not met Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF as he's often referred to. I have not met SBF, but our firms have interacted as a part of of FTX raising capital over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And we had opportunities to invest in FTX, and we said no. Now, I do want to just take a step back before I give you my answer as to why I said no. That simply put, what SBF and FTX got involved in was simple, old-fashioned fraud. Mm-hmm. It was fraud on a Madoff level. The size and scale of the fraud were so enormous that it is unique, but it is old-fashioned fraud. And just to give you a summary of what transpired with FTX took deposits into its exchange. You could buy and sell cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, deposit it into the exchange. And what SBF and his management team did was then take those deposits and transfer them in a variety of ways to Alameda, mm-hmm. which is their sister company, to invest those assets. And the investment team at Alameda was, to say generously, very poor in their decisioning in investing. And they mm-hmm. lost all of the investment money that depositors had made. The analogy here would be something like this. If you use Fidelity, which is a large brokerage house, if you use Fidelity or something like Fidelity, and you bought assets in Fidelity, deposited and custodied them at Fidelity, and Fidelity then just started investing your assets without your permission, that would be the analogy here. And that's what took place. So we didn't pass on FTX because we saw fraud, candidly. I think this was a blind side by many folks, but there was other red flags that we did see. And here are the red flags. So number one, the company is a 3-year-old company today.
Right.
All right. When they started fundraising at $18 billion, it was a 2-year-old company. And it was valued at $18 billion. That on its face should have thrown up red flags. And just to put this in perspective for the audience, if you're a 2-year-old company, statistically, you're probably worth tens of millions of dollars. And that's if you're hitting home runs. If you're hitting home runs, you're worth tens of millions of dollars. You are not worth $18 billion in 2 years. And subsequently, since that $18 billion valuation, they received a $25 billion valuation by another group of investors. Mm-hmm. After that, they received a $32 billion valuation earlier this year. In January of 2022, they received a $32 billion valuation for a 3-year-old company. And once again, The benchmark here is perhaps tens of millions of dollars of value they actually created compared to the $32 billion that investors were giving them. So that was an enormous red flag. Just to help put it in perspective, if you're investing at a $32 billion valuation, you would expect that for a venture investment, this thing may go to $100 billion valuation. You may expect a 3x return on it, right? And that is delusional. to think that FTX was going to achieve that end in any time soon, right? So there was friends of mine who I respect and I trust that were, I'm going to say they were hoodwinked by SBF and by FTX, and they chose to put money in it. And I would ask them, like, what do you see? You must be seeing something that I don't. And they would give me their justification and answers, but I never really bought the valuation argument. And that was number one. The second point that I would just touch on is that they were marketing on every sports arena,
right.
On every league, on Super Bowl commercials, on celebrity endorsements. They had an enormous marketing campaign. And for a startup, once again, that was 3 years old, they were spending more than JP Morgan would spend, right? They were spending more on marketing than the Goliaths of financial services would spend. So there was something off in that, that the expense management and cash management as well. For those two reasons, we passed on the FTX investment.
Now, what you're describing to me sounds like there's an allure about getting engaged in something that's highly speculative, and people adopt the attitude that, hey, I'm smart, I won't lose my money. That happens to other people, but it won't happen to me. So I want to go back to what you said a moment ago about the red flags. And undoubtedly, other people noticed the same red flags that you noticed. So why didn't more people come out and say, hey, this is not realistic. A company shouldn't be growing this fast. And if there was sort of that collective voice out there saying that something's off about this, that wouldn't succeed in cooling it off. Why does that sort of thing not happen?
Yeah, I also want to be fair in this. Now, over the past year and a half, as I and our team, our firm, has said no to participating and supporting FTX and SBF, I had my doubts, right? You have doubt. Did we make the right decision? Do I have any remorse in not participating? Because once again, you're seeing this rocket ship valuation. You're seeing very, very smart firms. I won't mention their names, but it's all over the media. Some of the brightest minds, some of the biggest shops all got involved in FTX. And you do doubt yourself. And so I in particular would not take the opinion of saying, if everybody else is wrong and I'm right, and you know, let me thump my chest.
Sure,
I wouldn't take that position, but I would quietly make my decision in that I'm not going to put my capital at risk on an investment that I don't believe in. And so I think, you know, it's just human nature, I think, is where I'm getting at. To your question, why wasn't there a whistleblower that came out sooner? Why wasn't an investor challenging all the other investors? It should have happened. But it's a good question to ask. And it's a good question that, you know, I think as most folks do post-mortem on this this analysis and this investment. And by the way, there's going to be so many case studies written about this. Every business school is going to research and understand what happened in this collapse. I'm convinced of this. And by the way, I myself, after I complete my doctoral program that we, JB and I, are both in, after I finish this, I plan to research and go down into the bowels of this analysis for research and for students alike to really read this at greater length.
All right. Well, with that in mind, we are going to take it a step further and get a little deeper insight into the crypto market. So I'm going to invite you to do a little role play with me. And in this role play, you get to be Sachin Jaitly. And I'm going to be playing the elected official who has invited you to a hearing to testify about cryptocurrency. And I'm going to say this. Mr. Jaitly, thank you for joining us today. I'm hearing from many financial experts that the risks associated with cryptocurrency are simply unmanageable. To have so much money brought into something that's unregulated is inviting the players in this market to engage in outright fraud and theft. And many people are losing substantial amounts of money. I think crypto needs to be regulated just like other kinds of investments, or it needs to be lawfully eliminated from the marketplace. What is your response to this?
I would welcome regulation. And let me share some analysis that I have in terms of what regulation exists and where we need to go. So by my estimation, most Western governments are not looking to ban cryptocurrency. They're not looking to ban blockchain because they see the true value that it can offer the world. And the adoption of it is unfolding as we speak. There's a great deal of adoption by companies adopting blockchain technology, and there's many investment firms that are getting involved in cryptocurrency and market. There's a lot of value there. But what I do see in the Western governments is that there needs to be clarification in the law. And that clarification comes with regulation, right? And let me just give you some examples. What does it mean to be a broker in our industry? That needs to be properly defined on a federal level. What does it mean to be a owner of an asset? If I deposit an asset in somebody's platform, who actually owns that property? That needs to be defined on a federal level. Mm-hmm. If a company is transmitting money from point A to point B, who is liable for any mishandling of those funds between point A and point B? That needs to be clarified on a federal level. So we welcome the conversations, welcome legislation, and do believe that we need a regulatory roadmap of certainty around our industry.
All right. Excellent. Thank you for indulging in the conversation in cryptocurrency, particularly now at this very interesting time. I'm sure there's a lot more that we could say about that, but right now we need to move on to our next topic, which is your backstory. And this gives us a chance to get to know you and understand your early influences. So you were born in Canada, you were raised in Central Florida, and you got your undergraduate degree at Rollins College in International Business. Then you completed your MBA at Crummer with a concentration in finance as part of the 3-2 program. We're going to come back to that a little bit later. And in the interest of full disclosure, I want to let our listeners know that I met you more than 10 years ago when you presented at the Crummer Venture Plan competition for Flex Receipts. And in the past 2 years, I've really gotten to know you because we've been in school together, working on our doctoral degrees at a different school. And so if you don't mind my saying so, I just want to share my impressions. The words that I would use to describe Sachin Jaitly are driven and ambitious. Now, I don't consider you arrogant. You're not a cutthroat, competitive kind of person. I just see you as being very quietly focused and very smart and very strategic in the way that you do things. So do you think that this is a fair description? And what words would you use to describe yourself?
Well, I appreciate those kind words, first off, JB, and it has been a pleasure to both know you and go to school with you. And not only is it, have you become, you know, one of the great classmates in our doctoral program, but you've become a great friend. So I do appreciate all that. Words that I would describe myself are probably a work in progress. So I just as everyone else, have both things that at this, especially at this stage of my life, that I recognize are my strengths, but fully recognize that there's areas of my development. And you know, I think Kobe Bryant once said that he, especially in his younger years, that he worked tirelessly on his weaknesses more than his strengths, so he could round out his skills, and so he could do things to surprise his competitors. Now, Kobe Bryant's on another level, so I'm not trying to draw any analogy with me, but it is a good lesson for all of us to learn. And I definitely am aware and acknowledge things that I'd like to improve upon. And but at the same time, I at this point in my life and at this point in my career, I also recognize where my strengths are and double down on those as well.
Would you say that there's an example from your earlier days when people might have seen you, or you might have seen yourself, as very driven and ambitious, or really just focused on improving yourself?
Yeah, there definitely is. I grew up in a household of entrepreneurs. And this dates back in my lineage, right? My great-grandfather to my grandfather, to my father, to I. And this is nothing really unique to, I'm of Indian descent, and I'm a first generation North American, now American. But my, you know, in that part of time, in that part of the world from India, everybody had an entrepreneurial spirit and everybody had a small business that they were operating. And so that stuck with me at a very early age. And I was constantly thinking about different ways to develop opportunities. I guess, first of all, to identify opportunities and then to develop them. And I would work with my father and my brother to consider, you know, what about if we started this type of business, started that? Mm-hmm. That would be a dinner style conversation that we would have, that we would all enjoy, that we would all participate. And as we all know, there's far and few topics at a dinner table that a family can really rally around. This was one of them. So we would all talk about, how would you think about, you know, starting this business, or how would you consider operating this business, or what do you think about this opportunity?
How old are you when this conversation is happening? How old were you when this happened?
I would say it started probably in late middle school and early high school.
Wow.
And as a part of that, you know, and for context here, my father operated a hotel. And so he would empower in me to help out in the hotel. And I would do, you know, all types of things. My brother and I would do all types of things to help out and to support him and support the family business in this exercise and this opportunity. And one thing in particular that I will call out is that, you know, we had a vending machine business on the property. And the vending machine business had, as you can imagine, snacks and sodas and other things, games, and get game room. And most people think that that is a very dismissive project. In actuality, you can generate hundreds of thousands of dollars in a vending machine business on a hotel, right? It's actually mm-hmm. quite a lucrative business to have. And so my father would ask my brother and I to go around, make sure all the vending machines were stocked, make sure all the inventory for those vending machines were in supply, make sure we could transfer all of the coins out of the vending machine, count those coins, package them, and then deposit and package them in those rolls, those coin rolls, and then deposit them into a bank and manage that business, so to say. Obviously, he would be managing it more day to day, but we were having a hand in that. And I think very early, I got a sense of there's opportunities all around. We just have to be prepared for them. And as dismissive as a vending machine business may be, I was able to see a unique dimension into this business that we operated and have a hand in really, you know, I guess in hindsight, I was almost operating my own P&L as a teenager, right? Through this little business. And so from that, my mind was open to look at different opportunities around every corner that I was engaged with from that point on.
It sounds like by being put to work at the hotel, you came away with the idea that all that loose change adds up to dollars.
That's right. That's exactly right. All of it did. And it was also, you know, on a personal level, it was also a great memory for my brother and I and my father, who has since passed, but for all of us to remember that we had those fun times together.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We are going to move on to your Crummer experience, and we're going to do that through something we do with every guest here on Crummer Connections, and that is Crummer Insider Free Association. This is the game where there are no right answers, no wrong answers, there are no winners, no losers, and there are no prizes. So I'm going to read you a short list of prompts, and for each one, I will invite you to say the first thing that pops into your head. Are you ready to play?
Yeah.
I started my MBA in the year...
2000.
And I graduated in the year...
2002, excuse me.
My favorite class was?
Oh, hands down, Securities Analysis and Portfolio Management by Clay Singleton, who was a wonderful professor. And since graduating, sorry for the long answer here, but since graduating, him at that time, Dean McAllister would come to New York, where I live, and host Kremer events. And so I had the fortune of seeing him after school a few times, and I really enjoyed those conversations.
From the whole experience, my greatest time management lesson was?
Yeah, on this one, I would say set weekly, or actually daily, weekly, monthly, and annual goals. And even today, this has stuck with me. If you ask me any day of week, anytime, what my goals are, I have a list of them for every day, every week, every month, every year of what I want to accomplish. When you have that frame of mind, it prioritizes all your deliverables in your timeline.
All right. That is great advice for anybody, not just for students. So I want to go back to something that I heard you say in one of your previous sessions on campus, and that was your attraction to finance classes as a student. So you graduated with a concentration in finance. And what I wanted to know was that a natural interest of yours, or was that something that just sort of came about? And when I asked you that on campus, you had a very interesting answer. So I want you to share that again with us.
Sure. So number one, it was a natural interest. I did want to learn more about finance. I did see my career going down effectively the CFO route. It was what I had projected. And, with all due respect to other disciplines, I felt for my skill set and what I wanted to achieve in my career as a CFO, I could learn some of the other disciplines perhaps easier on the job, right? Mm-hmm. If I needed to. But some of the financial tools that were being studied as a part of the MBA program at Kremer, I really needed to and wanted to sink my teeth into it. And I didn't feel I was going to have as a low risk environment in a job to be able to understand those things on the fly. And I thought those were going to be more complicated. So for me, in my journey, I wanted to over invest in these financial tools, understand what Sharpe ratio means, understand what WACC is, right, weighted average cost of capital, understand these theories. So then I could, number one, have the lexicon for them when I enter my career and people are talking to me about these terms. But number two, can start to process what they mean, how to operate them, and where to reference them if I do forget, right? I can go back, or I have this textbook, or I have this area that I can go and reference and dust it off. So for me, it was very important to achieve my goals that I was investing time and energy and trying to understand them, these concepts and theories in school.
And what would you say was the outcome of achieving your MBA? What did it lead to after you graduated?
So after I graduated my MBA, I was able to get into a finance role. And almost for a period of about a decade from graduating Kremer onward, I was effectively going down the CFO track in increasing responsibilities, increasing ways. Now, you know, when you graduate with a master's, I think you expect a certain degree of role responsibilities that are in your head. And in reality, when you graduate with especially an EA MBA, you graduate at a very young age, right? You know, approximately, let's just call it 22 years old. I think I was around there. When I graduated, I was very young, and I still had a lot of perhaps soft skills to develop to match my hard skills that I thought I had. As a part of a young man growing into his profession. And I say this all the time now. In my 20s, I overinvested in my, let's call it IQ versus EQ. So I invested in my IQ, these hard skills, in my 20s. And it was rightfully so. That's where I needed to spend my time. But my EQ probably needed to catch up. And I needed some of those soft skills in order to deliver communication or be able to tactfully influence others. And those came probably in my 30s. And I was able to start to kind of if you have a diagram of intersecting lines, I probably had a intersection somewhere in probably in my mid 30s where I felt, okay, my EQ and my IQ are finally at an equilibrium and I can probably effectively do what I need to get done for my role. And now I would say on at the point of my career I am now, and what I'm doing, I would say I almost over-index now on my soft skills versus my hard skills. I know them, I reference them, but I'm not necessarily grinding out massive spreadsheets on a day-to-day basis as I was.
Those of us who work in training and development are very grateful and appreciate your awareness. So thank you.
Yeah.
All right. And so we're going to move on to our next segment, which is about your career development and some turning points and takeaways. So when I was with you on campus recently, you talked about your career having three chapters. The first chapter was right after you graduated with your MBA and you were seeking corporate roles in finance. The second chapter was when you were an entrepreneur. And the third chapter is what you're doing now. And so what I would like to ask specifically is about the second chapter, which involves the time that you and two partners put together Flex Receipts. Tell us the story about how Flex Receipts got started, because I think this is a fascinating story, particularly to share with entrepreneurs.
Sure. So yeah, going back to that context of what I said earlier in terms of identifying opportunities around us, this was probably a manifestation of that idea. So one day, I had a very serendipitous moment. I walked into a CVS and I bought a single product. It was a vitamin water. Mm-hmm. And when I purchased that, out came a 2-foot long receipt. And, you know, we've all probably had a common experience. It's like, what in the world are they printing so much paper for this single product that I just bought? And so that day in particular, I took a closer look at this. I took a look at what in God's name is on this piece of paper. So on there, I noticed there's date, time, location. Mm-hmm. There's SKU information. There's pricing information. There's tax information. There's coupon information. And I thought to myself in this moment, oh my, there's a lot of data on this. What if I had this in a digital form? What could I do with this information in a digital form? But there's no way I'm going to carry this piece of paper around longer than a few minutes. And so into the wastebasket, that receipt went. And on the subway ride home that night, my then girlfriend, who's my now wife, I was talking to her about this idea. What if there was a digital receipt solution? What if the world had a digital receipt platform to issue digital receipts? And I want to put this in mind. You know, we're talking 14 years ago, perhaps, when this idea was born. And it wasn't as ubiquitous as it is today, right? This is almost pre-smartphone, right? When this idea came together. So nobody really had, or there weren't solutions out there that were really delivering in scale. So that evening, I get home and I'm chatting my then girlfriend, now wife's, ear off about this idea. And then I call up one of my best friends and tell him about this idea. He loves it. He's into it. And that evening, we found our domain name, flexreceipts.com. We started working on the business plan. And it just started snowballing from that point. It was a fascinating moment in my life that I'll never forget this day. And even when I talked to my co-founders, there's two other co-founders, they too mentioned to me that that first conversation is something that's just embedded in their brain. It was an exciting moment, I think, for all of us that we thought we could really change the way data and ultimately what we built was a data and analytics company. Things pivoted a few different ways, and that's ultimately what transpired. So it was an exciting moment that led me in my second chapter, which was as an entrepreneur and as an operator of tech companies for a period of time. And it was squarely in the world of data and analytics. It's kind of under the umbrella that people throw around today as big data. That's mm-hmm. That was the industry that I was really a part of.
Okay, I want a little more context. The time from, we'll just call that the moment of inception until you did the pitch at the venture plan competition, how much time passed?
Now, this is a little fuzzy, so don't quote me, but I'm going to say a year, a year and a half.
Okay.
Around that time.
About 18 months. And at its peak, before you sold, how many employees in the organization?
So the company had approximately, and by the way, I want to be clear that a separate, my co-founders continued building the company and ultimately exited the company. So I didn't remain as an operator at the very exit of the company. There was approximately, I'm going to use a number of around 30 heads of the company, and it was sold ultimately to Klarna, which is, as you well pointed out, is one of the largest fintech companies out of Europe.
All right. Thank you. That helps me just, again, get the lay of the land for what this entrepreneurial experience was like for you.
And if I may just say another point, JB, on that point. In the venture plan competition, it was a moment that I'm not going to forget. It was a moment of not only validation from a business school on our idea and on our team, it had a psychological impact for us, right? That we may be onto something. And it was also a capital injection. I believe the amount was $20,000 that we received from Crummer to continue building and working on our idea. And so these are milestones that for, and $20,000, the big scheme of a business is not that much capital. But when you're starting out, these small wins are very, very important. And that was a moment for us that we were very appreciative to the Crummer community for having faith in our idea and us as a team.
And I'm assuming that along the way, there were some setbacks that provided you with some valuable lessons. What was one of the setbacks that helped you grow in the very early days of Flex Receipts?
Sure. So, you know, one that comes to mind is, speaking of capital injection and getting funding, you go around, by the way, when you're a first-time entrepreneur and perhaps in your late 20s, a young first-time entrepreneur, you get told no a lot. And you have to have very thick skin. And it's very hard to kind of withstand all of that rejection. And you have to have a lot of conviction, a lot of courage in order to embrace that and get through it. So after getting told no by, I'm going to say, in the magnitude of 100 investors, we find an investor, the team, that has faith in us, that likes us, that likes the idea and is willing to cut a check. So we receive what is called in our world, a term sheet. We receive a term sheet for $600,000 to invest in our company. And a term sheet is something that like outlines the details of that investment. What is your valuation? How much ownership? What are the board seats? What are the liquidation preferences? A lot of fancy terms, but just essentially outline what the nature of the investment will be in our company. Huge moment. And so at that time, I'm living in Manhattan. We have a New York City attorney and straight out of central casting, high rise office for a big law firm, you know, big, beautiful conference rooms, big names. We're paying our attorney $700 an hour, right? Which is, by any stretch of the imagination, is a high amount. And he's walking in. And so we say, all right, attorney, we have this term sheet. Please let us know and guide us through this process. What should we do? So the attorney says, let's change that. Let's change this. Let's ask for more here. Let's ask for more there. And adding all this red ink everywhere, redlining the whole thing. And, you know, a young entrepreneur looking at this is saying, all right, okay, well, there's a very seasoned, well-to-do attorney who knows what he's talking about. Sounds great. All right. Let's give this term sheet as is over to the investor who was willing to cut that $600,000 check. Hand it over to the investor. I think it was within hours we received an email response saying this term sheet is terminated. I mean, something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But we were just like, facepalm, disappointed.
So close.
Thinking, what in the world did we just do? And by the way, we immediately jumped on the line with this investor. And this investor said, you know, I had doubts about this young team in this new market. And you have verified some of those doubts in this experience. And and I'll never forget this, what he told me. He said, and this is nothing disparaging against any attorney, but in this context of fundraising, he said, attorneys do not raise capital. Entrepreneurs do. And then he asked me, what do you need as a part of this term sheet? The answer on my side is, I need $600,000. Everything in here are wants. They're not needs in this term sheet. And this now, I call into question the ability for you to go out and do business development. Are you to create partnerships? Are you to create relationships? And so all of this was an incredibly painful moment, but a valuable lesson. Mm-hmm. So to this day, when an attorney hands me red lines, and they're doing their job, I want to be super clear. They're being paid to watch out for every sky falling moment as a part of any document that could potentially take place. And they're giving you their consideration. Now, what my job is to review them and see what I need versus what I want. And have the EQ, if I could go back to that, to understand what I can accomplish in this negotiation. Right? How much political capital do I really have as a part of this negotiation here? And so all of that, that whole experience was a very valuable lesson. And so I would share that with your audience as making sure to control the narrative, making sure that you understand all of the terms of any negotiation, and making sure you're really fighting for what you need in it, and don't get caught up with all of the other noise as a part of a conversation or negotiation.
Excellent advice for all of the entrepreneurs out there, and really just a great opportunity to connect on something that all of us have to go through at some point or another. All right, we're going to move on to our final segment, which is about your career and business advice. Taking into account that you have these three chapters of your career that you mentioned, what is your advice to young people who are getting out of school, running a business? What would you like to leave us with?
Sure. So there's probably a couple of life lessons that over my 20 years plus since Crummer that I effectively have learned. Number one, and I think this is so cliche, I assume a lot of people that are listening to this will roll their eyes, but it's still valuable and important to note. And that is, go after your dreams, go after your passion. Do not surrender your dreams. Do not surrender your passions. In life, those are valuable North Stars for you to pursue. You know, and when you're young and you hear, you know, dreams do come true, you're like, okay, roll your eyes, cliche. Tell me something real. But that is a tried and true statement. And over my career, I have definitely found that to be true. And I'm incredibly excited about what I'm doing now. I feel very fortunate that I'm doing something that I love, and it doesn't feel like work for me. And I pursued my passions in life, as risky as they have been. I have come out the other side better, stronger, and more aligned with what my real interests are. That's probably one. Number two is that I would say, on a more tactical daily level, be comfortable making decisions with imperfect data. There is no such thing as a perfect data set in the world. Even rocket scientists have to make assumptions from time to time, right? And that's why you have test runs, right? Everybody has assumptions, and we need to be comfortable being able to make decisions with imperfect data. And probably thirdly and related is that the ability to make decisions, period. Do not get caught up in analysis paralysis. It is important, and this is going to come over time with experience, with how much information is good enough. There comes a line, and that is a very subjective line, of how much data or information is good enough to make a decision. But do not get caught up in the ability to say, we need all information at all times before making a decision. That is a very risk-averse a thing that could truly paralyze teams, ideas, people. I see this all the time from daily experiences. People, even in school, I'm undecided about what I want to major in, or I'm undecided about what I want my career to be in, or I'm undecided about, in my career, what team to be on in the big corporate, or undecided which project I should be. My lesson that I've learned over time is that pick something. It's better to have a decent plan than no plan in life. So don't put so much pressure on it, right? You can pivot, you can change, you can adjust over time, but have a plan in place and make some decisions.
So in my world, we would interpret that and say that perfection is the enemy of progress. So thank you for sharing that. All right, we are about to wrap up our time together, and I want to acknowledge that I failed to mention this earlier in the interview, but you joined the alumni board in 2022, so we want to say thank you for your service. And what message would you like to share with the Crummer community today as we wrap up our time?
So thank you for the Crummer community, number one, for inviting me to be a board member as a part of the alumni board. It is great to be engaged from that perspective. And also, it has given me opportunities now to be on campus a little bit more. So I was invited to come and speak to two different classes, and also as a part of kind of the just a general Crummer group. And it was a reminder for me how special the experience is at Crummer. Now, when you're going through the program, you might be like me, and I was in a race to finish, right? I was in school. I wanted to get out. I wanted to start my career, start my resume. I wanted to pay down my student loans. You know, all of these interests and considerations are going around and are forcing functions for you to exit school. And those are good urgencies and healthy mindset to have to start your career. But in hindsight, it needs to be balanced with the awareness of how special of an experience Crummer is. And I reference my Crummer days all the time. And I look back on those moments as fond memories. And I think others will too. And so what I would say is, if you're going to the program right now, stop and smell the roses from time to time, because it is a special experience at Crummer, and it's one that I hold dear to my heart.
Excellent. Sachin Jaitly, thank you so much for joining us on Crummer Connections and sharing your story. It has been a great pleasure.
Thank you, JB. The pleasure is all mine.
Today's show is brought to you by the Crummer Graduate School of Business at Rollins College. Now is a great time to consider enhancing your career success by pursuing an advanced degree in business. And the Crummer School offers a variety of educational programs to help you become a global, innovative, responsible business leader. To learn more about the programs and begin the application process, go to crummer.rollins.edu. The Crummer Graduate School of Business, experience excellence. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon with another episode. Crummer Connections podcast series is a production of Victor Media Group. If you like this show, follow us on your favorite social media platform. Today's show was created and hosted by JB Adams and executive produced by Gerard Mitchell. Recording took place at the studios of WPRK, with technical and production design by Angel Colon, technical and production assistance from How Do, Dasika Gilkey, and Jayanne Gilkey, and final video and audio editing by Manny Simone. Our gratitude goes out to Mike Brown and Loveland Finley in Alumni Relations for their gracious help and support. Until next time, Fiat Lux.